has provided a grant in support of this program. Gray Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. It is Friday, December 24th, 2004. Sorry, 2004, 10:04 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Geek Speak time. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name is Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on Geek Speak, we're taking your calls with questions and comments about technology for the entire hour. Well, right after the news. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You can go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us to fill out some email form, which will get to our email inboxes, and we'll answer it on air. The questions and comments today can be about anything related to technology, and I do mean, well, anything. So please, feel free to grab that pamphlet of a computer you're trying to hook up and give us a ring, and we'll help you out. Again, phone number is 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about 15 minutes. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me are geeks Miles Elam, Java programmer, web developer, and student of American literature. Sean Cleveland, technical marketing communications manager for Transmeta. And, of course, John Tracy, owner and operator of FeltonGames.com. Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Lyle.
I'm going to start off the news. Before we get into our whole discussion, let's start off the news with Miles Elam, who just arrived just moments ago.
I don't know what you're talking about. I've been here for the duration.
Miles, wipe the sleep out of your eyes.
First off, I am very impressed with that Bill Moyers special that was on last hour.
Yes, that was a wonderful special.
Oh, I didn't see this.
This was on During Democracy Now. It was...
Oh, really? I didn't listen to that.
One of the reasons why I was late, actually, was I was sitting there listening to that.
But anyway, Miles, I said, you know what, we should talk about this because this is great content. I mean, it was just a wonderful speech. If you just tuned in and didn't hear Democracy Now!, Bill Moyers talked to, Democracy in the Air aired Bill Moyers speaking about the press and what the press looks like at this point.
And him talking about an informed populace.
And it was very, very good. If you'd like to continue that conversation, you're welcome to call in after the news and join GeekSpeak and give us your opinion as well.
But in actual geek news,
please.
Actually, I'm going to begin with a correction. In the past, I have said that the game industry had become bigger than Hollywood. While true with regard to... box office revenue from Hollywood, it is not true once you factor in DVD sales and VHS sales and rentals and the like. So whereas the game industry was beating the box office revenues of $9 billion, it does not beat the $16 billion overall. Or sorry, the $20 billion overall.
Wow.
Which is twice what the game industry
does. Okay. Well, that feels a little bit better, because it is everybody does go to movies, but not everybody plays games. So it made sense to me. But, well, thank you for that correction. I appreciate it. Sean, I'm going to go to you, sir.
Yeah, there's some kind of cool news for you Apple people out there. IBM is bringing a very cool feature from its high-end server processors down to its next generation of PowerPC 970 processors, which are in Apple computers.
Okay.
And IBM's Blade servers.
What's the feature?
The feature is called partitioning. And what it does, it relies on a concept called virtualization that breaks the link to the operating system so that you can run multiple operating systems.
Whoa.
So all you people who run soft Windows, that sort of thing on your Macintosh, well, with this next generation IBM processor, you'll be able to run those in their own processes.
Okay, so you...
On hardware.
Oh, wow. So theoretically, the operating system won't have to know... the Macintosh operating system, for example, wouldn't necessarily have to know that you're running Windows?
It wouldn't know.
It's a feature that's being moved from what's been commonly associated with mainframes. In the past, mainframes have had multiple images running at the same time.
That way you're not dedicated to a certain install. And you can. So the hardware is dealing with the separation of operating system on one machine.
Yeah.
I mean, you still have the
base,
problem.
The base microcode. I mean, the difference between software and hardware is the fact that the software is fixed in a separate
It doesn't mean, of course, that you're going to be able to run Windows on a machine that has this technology, because this is going to be happening in the Motorola chips, right? It's not going to be happening in the IBM chips that are PowerPC compliant.
If somebody makes a version that will run on that processor,
then Microsoft compiles a version for Power. But you could do a dual Linux and Mac OS.
Or older versions of Mac
OS 9, for example. That'd be nice. I wonder how they deal with the different hard driving spaces, like how they access memory. The memory is probably handled no problem, but how would it access the file systems? Would it be two file systems, or would they have to be in
Who knows? I would think that the best way to deal with that would actually be the move that we're seeing already, which is the network-attached storage.
Right.
So even if the hard drive is within the physical box, it to have some linkage where it's accessed as its own item, a dedicated processor for file serving, if you will.
Well, thank you very much.
She should get over a game running in the background on another pared down Linux OS.
Yeah, I was thinking there's the Miles has covered stories before about the CDs, which are the operating system and a game all in one kind of thing, the idea of that concept where now you just pop in your machine and you start running it, and theoretically, as long as the processor is okay, you don't care what operating system is on it at all, and you can be toggling back and forth and aiming people at the same time.
And when pressed about dual processor cores, IBM would not comment.
Okay, good to know.
What does that mean? Does that mean they're not having success with the technology?
Who knows?
And for the audience out there, dual processor core is like having two CPUs in one.
They're shrinking transistors so much that there's actually a lot of real estate on a processor die now, and they're trying to figure out what to do with this. Do you put more memory there? Well, that raises the price of the chip.
I wonder why.
And of course, processors are running faster, so they're running hotter, and that's a problem. IBM's running into that problem right now.
So if you slow it down,
so what Intel and AMD are doing are you slow the chip down, but you put two processor cores into one die.
Right. It's kind of like the choice between a really finely worked quilt and having a bigger quilt that's not quite as finely worked. You know, they...
Okay.
Well, maybe not.
Maybe not. Maybe anybody hear the crickets on that one? thank you. Thank you, Sean and Miles, I guess. John, your story for the day.
I want to talk a little bit more about the iPod... Apple's possible new flash iPod. This has been in the rumor mill for a while.
We talked about it last week.
Pretty much... They've talked to different flash manufacturers, and they've talked to a company that makes the brains that would process flash memory as an MP3 player. And yes, they have a deal with Apple, so it sounds pretty much a done deal. So they've interviewed a couple of different companies, like iRiver, which is currently the largest
competitor, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, they're not a competitor with Apple because they do primarily flash-based drives.
Oh, I see.
Apple does primarily hard drive-based MP3 players.
Uh-huh.
And they were asked, well, what do you think about Apple coming in? Because when Apple came in, there was already a small MP3 market. Apple's first year, they had 40% of that market, or 30%. The second year, they had 50%. Now they have over 80% of that market. Yeah, unusual for Apple. They're now going into, if they do go into the flash player market, iRiver was quoted as saying they welcome it because they see if Apple enters the market, it'll bring the market up. They'll increase the amount of traffic going into flash players,
right,
and they'll increase the the technology
I mean, if you start dealing with music players as a commodity level, Apple doesn't normally do very well in the commodity form where there's competitors with cheaper prices.
Right.
That's why Apple's at such a low point, is because when you look at it, it looks like Apple is more expensive than a Windows machine. Solutions, you buy two machines of the same basic stats, then the Mac's going to be more expensive. So if you do that same realm in the MP3 players, especially in the small form factor MP3 players, like these flash ones that are smaller size, therefore cheaper most likely, maybe Apple can't really compete in that space. And therefore, iRiver, people get into it, people like that idea, and it will probably help them in the long run. Unless, of course, Apple does something very different and maintains this amazing lead that it has. But
I think, it totally depends. Well, they assume they're shooting for around the $150 range. Definitely have to keep it under $250 or it'll interfere with their iPod. They assume they're going for a gigabyte, maybe larger.
That's pretty big.
Because they say that's the target market is about 4 gigabytes.
Yeah.
Most people don't need to carry more music than that. But now with the advent of video right. You know, looming as to coming onto MP3 players. People are going to be wanting larger hard drives.
I got to say, a flash, a 1 gigabyte flash is enough to take a jog with. It's enough to have, you know, unique music for hours.
It's a day.
As long as that, the one thing that I would say was crucial with that is that you'll be able to sync your that gigabyte of data quickly. So it's got to be USB 2 or FireWire enabled. If it's a USB 1 device, it's a gig transfer is going to be minutes.
Apple has never...
Yeah, they go with the higher stuff.
No, they're definitely going to do FireWire.
The only thing is that on most Windows machines right now, USB 1 is still the norm. The USB 2 on the newer machines... 1.1, okay. But the high speed that you get with USB 2 is not available on most Windows machines. And then FireWire, again, most people don't have FireWire in Windows. That changes if you buy a machine now, but in general. All right, well, thank you very much, John, for that news update about MP3 players. Sean's turn.
U.S. broadband use is up 38%. As of June 30th of 2003, there were about 23.5 million people online. Today, there are 38%.
Wait, people online, period, or?
Yeah, there were 23.5 million people online as of last June. Today, it's 32.5 million.
Wi-Fi.
No, internet.
Internet.
High-speed internet.
High-speed internet. Okay, high-speed internet.
Broadband. Okay.
Broadband.
That's kind of interesting.
I think that John and I both joined the ranks of that increased number. John and I both were able to finally get high-speed access.
Yeah, you guys sure did.
We were part of that number.
That's an FCC report. Their latest statistics show up 38%. And now broadband has surpassed dial-up in the United States, according to the Pew Internet and American Life Project. They find that 69% of broadband users go online on a typical day, compared with 51% for dial-up.
Well, it makes sense. You know, when you're on a Windows machine, when you're on a small speed dial-up, like a phone dial-up.
Yeah, you get on, do what you have to do, get off.
Yeah, and you don't need to do it every day. It's kind of frustrating.
When you're on broadband, you're more willing to what they call InfoSnack, which is where you you go off and look for data that's not really relevant to what you need to do, but it's there.
InfoSnap?
That's what InfoSnacking. Like snacking.
Right, yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah,
that's what it's called. The practice called InfoSnack.
Oh, great. Now I'm just... dreading
Miles
now
has been
that,
labeled.
Well, no, there's that. I'm just waiting for the slippery slope, you know, the now it's going to be talked about as information obesity.
Speaking of information
obesity. I love that. That is awesome.
Speaking of information obesity. Oh, yes, John. Yes.
And I have one more thing. Let's not forget that President Bush pledged during his 2004 re-election bid that there would be universal access to broadband by 2007. So
that
should be interesting.
That 50% we're at right now should increase.
That 38% increase is pretty good. But how many people are in the United States? A lot of people.
260 million, something like that.
Yeah, and only 32.5 million are on now.
Yeah, it's a long way to go.
Yeah.
I have affection for those people that aren't. Speaking about information obesity, Miles, your news story. Well, I mean, I only refer to you because you are informed beyond most people's weight. Go on.
It's coming from a guy who weighs like 160 pounds.
No. The only weight comes from the size of my head. Anyway, so...
Yeah?
You didn't...
There's a difference between head and ego.
Anyway. This is degrading rapidly. The ICU, unfortunately, I don't have the acronym ready. I think it's
ICU.
The International Communications Union, I think, something like that.
Probably, go on.
It's a body governing the use of radio frequencies around the globe. There's been a bit of a snafu, as it were, some computing technologies. Weather satellites use a particular frequency to check weather patterns, to check the amount of water in the air. The frequency they use is the narrow band that detects water vapor, but not liquid water.
Okay.
Something that you would need for detecting clouds,
when you say,
humidity.
When you say vapor, you mean water gas.
Gas is a vapor, yes.
Yeah.
Well, no, vapor is different than gas. Vapor is...
I'm not talking about steam.
Matter. Okay, so go on.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
All right.
However, apparently they've given that frequency to in-car radar.
Oh,
mobile
no.
phones and other commercial military applications. They're using the same frequencies.
So there's a lot of water being broadcast around.
Yeah, well, it's something, it's basically making a bunch of noise that the weather satellites can't get through. I mean, they're further away than most sources, and so they're going to drown out some local receivers.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is you can't just move weather satellites to another frequency, because the frequency they're using is specifically made
to detect water.
To detect water vapor and not liquid water.
Mm-hmm.
So what people are talking about is almost a doomsday scenario where they're saying the ability to forecast the weather will be no better than the 1800s. All of that information we had just gets drowned out.
Because the Doppler radar doesn't work anymore, or I don't understand what we're going to lose. As this other technology starts being used,
data.
The satellite data becomes useless.
All those times you're watching the evening news and it says, and the satellite weather data says, this is where they get their information from.
So they're going to basically start getting drowned out by this other military application of this data.
Well, not necessarily military. This is like car radar.
Car radar, but I don't know what car radar is. Like navigation finding?
It's an emerging technology.
Okay.
It's stuff like if there's something in front of you, like detecting how far and what velocity the car is in front of you.
Safety features, potentially self-drive features.
Right.
Okay. And right now it's being used in military vehicles only, but we're going to see it in the commercial market at some point.
Well, there are other military applications. I don't know necessarily that the car or the vehicles are
It's being used in civilian tests in L.A.
Right.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Miles, for that. We're going to continue with news as we take calls as well. We're going to go to Carl from Scotts Valley. Carl, welcome to Geek Speak. What's your question for the day, Carl?
Well, I'm one of those people who's just upgraded to broadband, and I have an older Max, older PowerBook, 1400 upgraded to a G3 that I want to connect to this network. Is that possible, advisable? Can I
get on there with it? How old is this PowerBook that you've got?
It's a 1400 upgraded to a G3. It's about 7 years old, I think.
Does it have an Ethernet port?
Yeah. Well, it does on a little, a little PCMI card.
Right. Yeah.
And what do you want to do? Just you want to use it with a high-speed connection?
Yeah. How do you do it?
It should be relatively. Are you running OS 9?
OS 8.1 on the old PowerBook.
Okay.
I have to upgrade?
Well, I don't think John and I can blindly lead you through all the settings with 8.1 because it's been a while since we used it. Actually, I don't think I've ever used 8.1, but. What you basically want to do is get a DSL hookup for your home, and then you want to get a router right away.
Yeah, I have all that.
Okay. Then plug it's all software.
He wants to know if he can do it wirelessly, though.
Oh, wirelessly.
No. Actually, just plug it
just
in
plug
anyway.
Just plug it in?
Yes, absolutely.
You shouldn't have a problem. It should be a breeze to do it.
The only thing I'd recommend is upgrading your operating system to at least 8.6, because that was the point at which Apple started using real TCP/IP.
Uh-huh.
As opposed
right.
to Apple's version of TCP/IP, which was...
John, I love that you know this kind of stuff. I didn't know what operating system level. I just knew that somewhere in the 8s it started happening.
Yeah, it's 8.6.
Okay, so that's the first trick.
It should be a free upgrade if you go up to Apple's website.
Oh,
yes, John is the alpha Mac dog.
Uh-huh. Wait, that's a free update?
8.6?
Yeah.
It should be.
As long as you can find it?
You have to do the upgrade path from 8.1 to 8.5, then to 8.5. Might have to do some other version 8.5 and 8.6. But first, obviously, make sure that your PowerBook 1400 will run 8.6. You might have to go up to 9.1.
Well, he's upgraded to a G3, so it should be okay, right?
Yeah, it should be.
Uh-huh.
The only other thing, of course, is that he's got to download all this stuff, and he's got to do it with a slow connection. How frustrating is that?
You can set everything up to connect in 8.1. There is a TCP/IP control panel in 8.1.
Okay. I would get that first, because it's going to be a lot easier.
But it's not called TCP/IP. I think it's under the Apple Talk, or it could be under network connection. It's something funky. It's not called what you'd think it would be called, and I can't remember what it is off the top of my head.
Mm. Yeah, it has been a while since we've used the older machines.
But you can definitely hook 8.1 up to an Ethernet network, which is what you're doing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
You might want to go up to, there's a site called Low-End Mac.
Lowendmac.com.
They often have tutorials on how to do stuff with Macintoshes.
Right.
They may have here's how you hook up your older PowerBook to a...
Right,
here's how you get 8.1 to connect to TCP/IP.
Good. I thought at first this would be a boring question for you all, but I imagine that a lot of people are now, like you say, are now upgrading to this faster Internet connection. So they have all these old machines, like me, and want to know whether we should throw them away or keep them.
Oh, no, those old machines are perfect for surfing the net. You just need to figure out a way to get connected.
Uh-huh.
Wireless is a little tougher, but any old computer with Ethernet port can have, broadband accessibility.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, great. So you just need an Ethernet network connection. Wireless, especially in a notebook, an older notebook, that's an issue, even on the PC.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, great. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the call.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye.
I'm just looking at my notes here. Open
call
trans
from Scotts Valley.
That was...
Hold on. Let me turn that off.
All right.
Apple went to Open Transport right around 8.1. Open Transport was their communications protocol, but it still wasn't real TCP/IP until 8.6. So if you can get 8.6, do it, because it'll make it really easy. Everyone you talk to who says, oh, well, then you just put the IP address right here, it'll actually be there, as opposed to using Mac. I think it's Mac PPP that you use at that point.
That's right. I recall it was kind of hard to do.
Yeah. Nothing's called the same.
Right. And actually, when you had an older Mac, what would happen is you'd get an ISP that was pretty friendly with you, and they would give you a CD with the software you needed on it to connect up. But that was, of course, with dial-up. I don't think they do that kind of thing anymore with DSL. The phone numbers, if you'd like to call in and join our show today, we're answering your questions and comments. We'd love to answer your questions and comments about a Windows machine, but we can also handle Macintosh, as we seem to do a lot on GeekSpeak. Don't know why that is. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. We're standing by. Of course, you can get in our email inbox by going to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. I'm going to keep on going with the news until we get other calls coming in. Sean, actually, you know, it is Miles' turn, and he seemed a little upset that I skipped him last time. So, Miles, Elam...
Did we just talk about
today?
No, he just did one.
We did one.
I just did one.
Okay, we won't do two. John?
Yes.
Go ahead.
The probe that's attached to the Cassini.
That's a good one.
Yeah, the Huygens.
Huygens.
Huygens. Huygen.
I think it's Huygens.
Which, of course,
Huygens. Huygens probe.
It's named after Danish astronomer?
He's the first guy that found the moon, I believe, right?
I don't know.
Okay,
possibly.
Go on.
Go ahead and say that. It sounds great.
It's the first guy that found the moon.
This is the probe that...
this is the probe that's attached to Cassini. Cassini is currently in orbit around... It's currently in orbit around Saturn. And sometime in the morning, 10:08 p.m.
today.
Eastern time. So it'll actually be Christmas, early Christmas morning where we live. Oh, no. Actually, it won't be. It'll be 7 and... It'll be 7
anyway.
At night, Christmas morning. They're going to release the probe from Cassini.
Fire
and this is a big deal because it's been on there for 2 years. It's traveled over 2 billion miles. So, and it's got these explosive bolts that go to release it.
Now, are they going to release it so it goes and starts going around Titan, or is it already around Titan and it's going to go into the atmosphere of Titan?
No, I don't know if it's in orbit around Titan. I would doubt that it's in orbit around Titan because it has other missions around Saturn.
So what's happening basically is this thing is going around Saturn. It's going to fire something.
Right. This is the beginning of the insertion of the probe into orbit around Titan, and eventually the probe will enter the atmosphere of Titan.
Right.
In 3 weeks, which coincidentally, almost to the day, is the one-year anniversary of the Spirit rover on Mars, which
might still be running.
Actually, it's doing great. If I can segue into another news segment,
you just did.
There's some kind of, they don't know what's going on exactly, but for some reason, the probe Opportunity, the second rover that was sent there, Opportunity, has had its solar panels cleaned. Originally, when they landed, they were putting out over 800 watts of energy, the solar panels. Spirit, the first one to land, has been slowly degrading due to accumulation of dust on the panels, and it's down to about 400 watts. Same thing was happening to Opportunity, which was the second rover to land. Suddenly, something happened, and it jumped back up to 800 watts. It's been inside a crater called Endurance Crater, so it's been angled just right. But now they've driven it out of Endurance Crater. It's on the flat plains. They've lost about 15% efficiency in the solar panels.
From the tilt, that's correct.
From the tilt, but it's still at over 700 watts.
Wow.
And they don't know what happened, if a dust storm came by or Martians with Windex or what.
I think Martians with Windex.
That's my
guess. And, of course, we did cover this topic on the June 25th show of GeekSpeak with Joe Jordan. Talked all about the mission. And
for Cassini.
For Cassini.
Right.
And we also talked about the Huygens probe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was a great show, and it's not archived, unfortunately. I'll try to get that up at some point in the next few days. Thank you, John, for that story. I'm going to go now to Sean because he has something in the hopper. Sean?
Yeah, actually, NVIDIA announced a new technology for an existing video card this week, which is kind of cool. It's their newest video card, the GeForce 6 series of graphics chips. They don't actually make video cards. They make the chip, the graphics chip. And other companies make the card, but anybody who's got a GeForce 6600 based video card, download the new drivers, and you'll get support for high-definition MPEG-2 hardware acceleration. So if you're planning to build a media center, this might be a cool option for you because you can play DVD movies and use the graphics chip to accelerate that movie using its own hardware.
Right. So you're not tagging the processors.
Right. You're not tagging the processor so much, and probably not burning as much, using as much power, especially if you're using a notebook or something.
How is that different from the MPEG-2 or DVD acceleration that's been in video cards for a while now?
Well, this is the dedicated 16-way vector. It's a little more complicated, yeah. It not only supports MPEG-2, but it supports HD hardware acceleration.
Okay, so
high definition. So I'm not quite sure how it compares to MPEG-2 DVD decoding, but HD acceleration is pretty cool.
Bigger, larger, faster.
And it supports WMV high definition hardware acceleration, high quality real time video recording, spatial temporal adaptive deinterlacing. For those people out there who are into video, this probably makes sense to you. Flicker free multi stream scaling, bunch of cool features. So any video files out there, if you're going to build a media center, you might want to consider the GeForce 6 series.
I was expecting a partridge in a pear tree at the end of that.
Yeah.
This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. If you have questions or comments, the numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You can use the Internet. Go to geekspeak.org. Click on Contact Us.
The Santa Cruz Museum of Natural History presents the 30th Annual Fungus Fair, Saturday and Sunday, January 8th and 9th, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Loudon Nelson Community Center. Call the Museum of Natural History for information at 420-6115.
Hi, John. Can you turn me up, please?
Why? You're
thank you
say
very
things.
Much. This program is supported by a grant from Cruise.io, providing internet services, including DSL, spam filters, PHP, MySQL. Now with nationwide access, information about Cruise.io membership is available online at Cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxel. The geeks this morning are John Tracy, Miles Elam, and Sean Cleveland. You're welcome to join the show by calling 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. We're taking your calls and questions and comments about technology. And first, we're going to go to Miguel from Santa Cruz. Miguel, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi, Miguel. Welcome to Geek Speak.
What's your question?
Hi. I have a question about cursor arrow on an older Mac.
The cursor arrow?
Yeah, uh-huh. The arrow, yeah. At some point during, some maxing of the processor, I think, the cursor appears to just pixelate, kind of explodes. Have you ever seen that happening?
Yeah, I've seen that before. You're running.
It sounds like a fable.
You're running a pre-OS 10, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You guys should have a low-end Mac radio version for this show.
Yeah, really. There's a lot of people still using Mac. See, this is one nice thing. You buy an expensive Macintosh, and then you're still using it 10 years later.
You milk it for years.
You don't want to let go.
Because it works. It's still good.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's going on?
This show is not brought to you by Apple, by the way.
<I'm kidding>. It's brought to you by old technology.
I mean, the last time when it happened is when I'm trying to download an attachment from Hotmail.
John, what is happening with an exploding cursor? You sound like you know what
there's
it is.
There's a corrupted file inside the system suitcase.
And when you say exploded, does it it has animation of explosion?
No. That's what I'm saying.
Suddenly the cursor is being drawn within. The cursor has a box.
Okay.
It says it can be this big. This box can be this big, and anything within that can represent a cursor.
Okay.
It's so people can make custom cursors. What happens is it starts drawing your cursor randomly throughout that box.
Oh,
so imagine
it looks
you
like
take
it kind
an arrow.
Of blew up a little bit.
Yeah, you take that arrow and you just spread it all over the box. That's what's happening. So it looks like an
exploding. So as long as you point the bottom left-hand corner of the box at something and click.
It's
the top left?
Top left.
Yeah,
it's no problem. You have an interesting mouse.
No,
so
you
how
can
do you
reinstall
get out
of it? You have to reinstall the operating system to
oh, really, for that,
that.
For, to avoid that?
Unfortunately.
And okay, so what I'm
wait,
what
why
I'm
is your Mac so good now?
No
yeah,
kidding.
That wouldn't be a problem. What I'm wondering is, what about the attachment? Am I going to be able to get it then?
Oh, yeah. The mouse should have no effect. You could keep using a machine with that weird mouse. It's not going to affect anything. It's just
all right, and by the way, 8.5, you do have to get before you upgrade to 8.6.
Okay, good to know. Thank you.
Yeah.
Miguel from Santa Cruz, thank you very much for calling.
Are you sure you just can't change the appearance of the mouse to a different one?
You can.
One and then back?
Couldn't you just put another? No, because it's having problems drawing it. The file for the mouse is probably okay. It's just drawing it. You know, I got to say, and this is something, if you're using an older machine, like a machine that can only support OS 8, or so on a Macintosh, go ahead and go to an Apple store and take or to any Fry's or some big place that has machines for display and just play with something else. Launch something that you're familiar with, like Photoshop, if you use Photoshop or something. You will be amazed at how fast a newer machine is. The technology doubles, the speed doubles every year kind of thing, every 18 months. So if you're dealing with a six-year-old machine, you're pretty far behind.
That's actually on the PC. Wow.
That's true. On the Macintosh, it kind of crawls along, but the newer Macs are much better, and any Windows machine you pick up now in a store is going to be better than an OS 8 compatible
for at least 6 months.
Yeah, and be sure to hurry because, well, it's Christmas Eve, so the stores are going to be closing early today.
I think there'll be sales next week. Lots of them. All right, thank you.
After Christmas sales?
Yeah,
sure. I've heard of those.
We're going to welcome on Geek Dee Dee from New York as kind of a joining the show kind of thing. Dee Dee, you with us?
Yeah.
Hi,
Dee Dee.
Hi, Dee Dee. Let's push the VIP person for Dee Dee so she locks in. There's a little button right next to Dee Dee, the VIP. Now we can't hang up on her.
Awesome.
Dee Dee, how's New York? Is there snow?
It snowed before I left. I'm actually in California.
You're in Southern Cal. Are you coming up to Northern California? Are we going to see you?
Like to, but Northern California seems to be coming to us.
Yeah?
My aunt and uncle are supposed to be here later today.
Darn, we're not going to see Dee Dee this year. Okay, Dee Dee. I want to talk a little bit about one of your projects you're working on at NYU. You're in the ITP program at NYU, which stands for Interactive
Telecommunications.
Okay, and it's an MFA program. And you're currently, one of the things I want to talk about is the Flickr Bicker project. First, can you tell us what Flickr.com is and the URL?
Flickr.com is the new crack at ITP. But
everybody loves it.
Everybody loves it.
I'm sorry. Back up. ITP.
At
we just
ITP.
Covered that. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I was just
the program she's in.
Right. I'm
so Flickr, which is without the er, without the e at the end. Flickr, Flickr. .com.
So otherwise, you go to a place that says bartender, give me a Flickr.
Right. is a photo sharing solution. You make an account, you create your images, and then you can see other people's images. It's all about sharing your photographs online. It's kind of like a Friendster of photography, and it's pretty cool. They offer a certain amount of megabits per month for free, and then they have paid service, which is, I'm assuming, unlimited to some degree. And basically, it's a great way to share photos between friends. You post a photo every day and everybody else posts a photo and you see your friends' photos show up, and it's kind of cool. And it's, again, Flickr. So, Dee Dee, you made a project that kind of uses the Flickr program or interface, if you will. Oh,
right.
Can you talk about that?
Besides being a really great photo sharing app platform, it's got a really great API. So that's really great for people like me who want to try to utilize some of Flickr's benefits in their own projects.
Mm-hmm.
So we built on top of their API some calls to grab pictures that people put into. You can have these groups on Flickr where you can all put in pictures for a particular topic or whatnot. So for Bicker, which was the project that I worked on, we had people drop certain pictures for different contests that they wanted to participate on Bicker. Bicker is all about hardcore photo battle is the tagline, but we're working on the hardcore part. Right now, you can enter photos into contests like art or not, so you can decide, is this art or is it not? It was supposed to be sort of a funny tongue-in-cheek thing for the ITP winter show,
mm-hmm.
where everybody shows their projects. You take a picture of a project, and then people vote up or down whether or not they like the picture or whether or not they think it's really art. We also had some other contests, like $20 contest is really popular. Like the idea being that there goes another $20. You take a picture of something in which, you know, the total sort of adds up to about $20 or so, and you show how it's just been wasted or gone awry.
So basically anybody that joins the system can input their photos for the $20 wasted, if you will, and then other people get to vote on which one they like the best. And you see this big collection of all these photos that have the same theme, and then you vote on which one's good or bad.
Right.
I like it.
They're sort of like an online form of Bicker so that people can sort of view what's going on from the outside. But That's at bickr.com, spelled just like Flickr, but with a B.
BICKR.com.
Correct.
I'm going to go ahead and go to other calls. We're going to try to keep you on, Dee Dee, but there is some kind of strange phone thing happening, and I'm not going to get into it right now. But in any case, from Santa Cruz, line two, Albion, welcome to GeekSpeak. Did I pronounce your name correctly?
Thanks.
Thank you. Did I pronounce your name correctly?
Oh, yeah, you did.
Great. Thanks. Albion, what's your question?
I'm shopping for a new laptop, and I think any of them would fulfill my computing needs because that's not real big. But I don't have a television, and I want something that does DVDs well.
Okay.
And so I was wondering if you had any advice on that.
Yeah, I think pretty much any machine you're going to get right now, any laptop machine, is also going to be able to run DVDs. You do want to get a laptop?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't think you're going to find a laptop, except for a low-end laptop or a very ultra-light laptop, that doesn't have a DVD player in it. It's a pretty standard thing now. Sean, would you agree that most laptops now come with DVDs, DVD players?
The
light end. I mean, not the ultralights, but the standard.
Yeah, so a desktop replacement type notebook, the larger 2 gigahertz, 3 gigahertz, they're like weighs 7-8 pounds, and they're not 2 inches thick, 2 to 3 inches thick. Those will have an integrated DVD.
You can get, and they play the movies well. I mean, it's something you can enjoy watching them on.
Right.
Yeah, you might want to look more at a corporate notebook than a consumer. Those will for sure handle playback of DVD.
Yeah,
and they're better tuned to save your battery too.
What
because
would those be?
They expect the
basically when you go to a site, what that is when you go to a site like Dell or something like that, and you start looking at machines, they're going to say home user
or business.
You want to do the small business thing.
Oh, okay.
It's going to cost you a little bit more, but it'll be a better made notebook.
It'll last longer.
Yeah.
I think we lost Dee Dee.
Sorry about that.
We're not going to be able to take your second call. We lost Dee Dee in there for dial tone. We had to hang up on both our callers. But we did answer, I think. Let's continue on Albion's question just a little bit. A DVD player for the home, on a laptop machine, Sean's suggesting you get kind of a corporate version of a laptop. It costs more, but it's more
durable. It'll cost you a little more, yeah.
Better parts.
But in a lot of DVD players in those units, and even some consumer devices, will also burn CDs as well.
Yeah.
That's called a combo drive. The problem with getting something too thin, and if you get an external DVD drive to play your movies on, you've got to power it.
Right.
And if you're on an airplane, you can't power an external drive unless it's built into the notebook somehow.
The biggest thing with playing a DVD on a laptop is most likely you have to plug in power. If you don't plug in power, your laptop life isn't going to last that long.
Sharp just came out with a new notebook called the MP30, based on the Transmeta processor.
Sure.
It's a company I work at. It's kind of a cool feature, and I'm seeing it more and more in notebooks. You don't even have to turn the computer on. You don't have to boot into the operating system.
Right.
So you can actually open up the notebook, pop in your DVD, and hit a special power button, and it'll just start playing the movie. So that saves a lot of battery, because you're not using the hard drive.
Right. Is that something that's coming standard most places?
I'm starting to see it more and more. And I played with one, and it's amazing. It's a great feature.
Yeah.
If you just want to watch movies, in this instant on, just starts working. So that's a really great way to go.
All right.
So you might want to look for that feature.
In general, when you do get if you're going to an outlet place that has machines on display and you're questioning about this, just tell the rep, go look, if you grab a DVD and play a DVD for me and I can sit here and watch it for a few minutes and make sure the machine can handle it and it doesn't get too loud,
yes,
then I'll buy this machine. But if you can't do that for me, I'm not going to buy the machine.
Yes.
They will get a DVD and they'll put it in there for you.
If they grab a drama or a comedy, something that doesn't have very much movement, tell them you want to see an action flick.
Yeah, you want action. You want explosions. You want a lot of movement, car chasing.
Because you want to push the notebook as hard as you can to make sure it can handle something,
right,
you know, a movie like that.
All right. We're going to go to – I've lost track of lines. I think line four has Seal from Moss Landing. Seal, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. How are you?
Quite well. What's your question?
Well, I work at a publisher where we're trying to send newsletters electronically.
Okay.
And we create them in InDesign.
Great
use
application.
Graphics from Adobe Illustrator and also Quark.
It sounds like you know what you're doing.
We put them into PDF files and ship them off to the customer, and then we get comments that some customers can't print them on Lexmark and HP PostScript printers. And I'm wondering if you have any idea what we're doing wrong.
Okay, well,
or what we could do to make it better for our customers.
I don't think it's on your end.
Yeah, you always have complaints from customers about printing.
Seriously.
But it sounds like, I mean, it sounds like you're making the PDFs for print purposes. There's two ways to make a PDF. You can make PDFs for just screen.
Exactly.
So it sounds like you're making a print for PDF, and because you're rich on content, if you will. You got a lot of graphics, you got fonts and stuff of that nature.
Uh-huh.
They're going to view that PDF on their machine. It has to print, and to get it to print, they have to, depending on their machine, they're going to have to load that whole content into the printer's memory.
Yeah.
And that's the error that's happening, and it's nothing really you can do
actually,
about it.
There are secrets you can do.
What, Sean, so, you're going to have to tell your customers about these secrets.
No. Instead of exporting to a PDF file, print to a PDF.
We're not exporting. We print through Distiller.
You do.
And we've been trying both the ebook level and the print level. Do you know anything about a security issue with the ebook level?
Well, the ebook level, that's not really... I wouldn't go with the ebook level because you are going to be touching the security levels. You want to do a screen version, but then if you printed it, it'll look horrible. So you're
not necessarily. You go into the printer driver and you select a higher, lower compression or a higher quality.
When you choose to print to create the PDF via print,
You go to properties in the printer driver itself and increase the resolution that way.
Not the user doing that. You doing it when you create the PDF.
No, when you go to print, you'll see the print dialog there.
Uh-huh.
You actually have to go into the advanced printer properties.
Advanced, uh-huh.
And then it's in the bottom left-hand corner of the InDesign box.
Okay.
And underneath the picture.
Yeah, I know where it is.
And you go in there, and that's where you select the high quality. And you might want to check in there to see what other settings you have.
You're basically trying to produce a low enough quality one that people won't run into printing problems that will still look good when it gets printed. And that's you're not going to solve everybody's problem. That's just
terrible download time or email attachment.
That's right.
Problem.
You will reduce the size of the file as you compress it more, and therefore people won't have to download.
And what you're doing by increasing the quality is you're not compressing it as much.
Right.
But, you know, as always, you're going to have a problem with color matching. It's just a PDF thing.
Right. Well, I don't think that that's the big problem. I think it's more that, because I have a test Lexmark that I use.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's just a mess. Sometimes the graphic, the fonts and the graphics spread out all over the page.
You know, this
it's like
is
crazy.
Yeah. The other issue that's kind of interesting about this is another one of those cases where... you might have, a person that has a working printer that can print pretty much anything
mm-hmm.
has a newer printer and potentially has a for small business printer. It has more memory in it.
Right.
And therefore, you're going to have less problems running into it. But pretty much any printer at this point, you're not going to run into that kind of problem. The people that are complaining with errors are most likely using older machines, losing older printers. So I don't know what to tell you except that you can tell them to go ahead and read it on screen if they can open it. You could also provide a second lighter version for people to complain. Make it screen quality.
Good idea.
But then when they print it, it's going to be kind of unfortunate.
You might want to choose a lower version of Adaptec as far as when you actually print the document, you can set if what the compatibility of the version number of Adobe Acrobat. So I think it defaults to Acrobat 5.
Yeah.
You might want to try 4.
Seal, thank you very much for the call.
That would increase the compatibility of the file.
Huh.
Yeah.
Seal, thank you very much for the call. We're going to say goodbye to you now.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. And we're going to go to David on line 5 from Monterey. David, what's your question for the day?
Hi.
Hi.
I've got a few questions. I'm recently got slimed by Bloodhound and Spybot Worm.
Okay.
And then I have tried on the recovery disks to reboot the thing and start
and your
over.
Machine is basically you can't function?
Right.
Okay. Yeah, did you reinstall your operating system?
Well, unfortunately, I started up the program before I started up the recovery disks, and now the recovery disks are gone. I can't reboot the recovery disk.
You can't reboot the from the recovery disk?
Right.
Okay.
That could be because your machine's not set to boot off the CD before it boots off the hard drive.
Yeah.
Okay, so on a Windows machine, you want to hold down the...
Yeah, it's usually the delete key or the function 2, F2 key, right when you turn the machine on.
Yeah.
And you should be able to go into the BIOS. It's going to be on your typical BIOS settings. You'll be able to set the boot order. And what you want to do is make sure that the CD-ROM is set to boot as a boot device.
Yeah.
Maybe it's the first boot device, and then set the second boot device as the hard drive.
Okay.
And that should probably do it. But also, you don't have to do your boot your install from recovery, your disk that you made from recovery. Are those the disks that came with your machine, or
yes.
is just okay? Then that's the ones you want to use.
And also, when you are booting from a CD, you need to actually hit a button at a certain time to boot off the CD. So you got to watch your computer, and right before it boots, like it would typically would into Windows, mm-hmm. you should see a little text message that says, "Press any key to boot off the CD." You need to make sure you do that.
Okay.
And if you set up the CD to boot and you reboot the machine and you walk away, it's still going to boot to a hard drive. You actually got to hit a key to say to boot off the CD, because it's detecting that you have Windows there.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a tough one.
Yeah. And the other thing is that I'm my internet provider. Can I say the name?
Please.
Oh yeah, Earthlink. I'm doing Earthlink, and I've had that for quite a while. It's been good. But I'm starting to get things coming through there that I really don't want. Even when I booted up the machine for the Windows program,
mm-hmm.
and I just wonder what was going on. Do I have to make get a new account there, or has that ever happened before? Then?
But you're getting stuff installed.
Yeah. Well, that's one thing, and. The other thing is that I'm getting my computer and messages that say my computer or my program has asked for blah blah blah.
Well, that sounds like you've got a security feature enabled, which is actually probably good. When it says it's asked for, is it like asking you for permission to run something?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's probably a good thing. You say yes to the applications you know about and no to the applications you don't.
Okay.
You probably have spyware software enabled, or some anti-spyware, anti...
I'm actually thinking the messenger service might be popping up, and I'm trying to open up some ActiveX. You may be getting some adware attempts and spyware.
Yeah. We on the December 3rd show of this month, we talked to Gary Gusnoff, CEO of eBlocks.com. He has some products. The show is available online. If you can listen to archived shows, just go to the December 3rd show. It's MP3 format. You can listen to suggestions that we have on that. About
the biggest one is not to use Internet Explorer.
Yeah, that's a big one.
As your browser.
How does one not?
Actually, before that, are you using XP?
Yes.
Okay. I'm willing to bet that you haven't put Service Pack 2 on it yet.
Yeah. You want Service Pack 2. Okay, so what you do, go to the Start button, and then the very top of the list, pretty much, is the Windows Update. Click on that. It'll open up Internet Explorer.
You need
and
to go to Start,
you.
Click on All Programs, and at the top you'll see Windows Update.
Thank you very much. And when you get up there, just do that. You'll go to a website for Microsoft, and you'll start downloading. You want to do the Service Pack 2. It's going to take forever on a slow connection. And you can also go to Microsoft's site and ask them to send you a CD.
It only takes about a week to get it, and it's free.
And that's a great way to go. And then you have that CD whenever you want to reinstall your
From what you're describing, that should be your first step.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Go get that Service Pack 2.
So that will turn off that little alert thing.
Then to stop running Internet Explorer, just don't run it. You need to download another browser.
You can go to Mozilla.com.
Mozilla.org.
So .org. Miles, spell it, please.
Mozilla.org.
And download their application called Firefox for your operating system. Mm-hmm. And then you'll run that as your browser. And it will import your bookmarks, and you'll be set.
Yeah, as soon as you first install Firefox, it'll go off and import all your Internet Explorer settings and bookmarks.
And when you use it, it'll say, "I'm not your default browser. Do you want me to make me your default browser?" And you say, "Yes."
David from Monterey, I want to thank you and say goodbye to you now.
Okay, sir.
Actually, real quick, just to talk about Mozilla.
Please go on.
There was a news story this week that Mozilla Foundation is integrating the calendar into Thunderbird.
The Sunfire project.
The Sunfire project. And what they're trying to do is build an Outlook killer.
So what's that project, the Sunbird project, you said?
The project's called Lightning.
Okay, Lightning.
And what they're doing is they got this software, this calendar software called, was it some, did you
oh,
say?
It's Sunbird.
Yeah,
Sunbird.
It's called Sunbird from a company in Silicon Valley.
Which makes a really good calendar system called Sunbird.
Yeah.
Go on.
So anyway, they're integrating Sunbird calendar into Outlook so that you can tie your emails into calendar features. which is why people use Outlook today.
That's a big problem. I mean, actually, yeah. Miles recently wrote a great article, we'll probably air at some point, about using machines safer. And one of the excuses people have for using Outlook, a common one.
Well, one of the good reasons for using Outlook.
Is it's got this great countering system that's integrated with the email client. So you can receive a invite to a meeting and say yes, and it adds it to your calendar automatically. And in a corporate environment, that's a kind of necessity to have that kind of tie-in. It's a very good feature.
Yeah, and there's also the Exchange server integration, so you can actually check to see what other people's schedules are.
And also see what, share files and stuff. So that kind of feature set is something that kind of locks people into using Outlook. And Outlook traditionally is a good spreader of viruses. So what we suggest always on GeekSpeak is that you download Mozilla.org's Thunderbird email client, which all of us use as our email client. And it's a great email client, and it doesn't have the security defaults, but it doesn't have a calendar,
although there is,
except now it's coming.
Well, Sunbird is available in version 0.2.
But it's not integrated.
It's not integrated. You actually have to go find it at Mozilla and install it. And it's not fully featured either yet.
Didi, what do you use for an email client?
On my Windows machine, I use Thunderbird.
Okay. On the Macintosh, you use Mail?
Mac, I'm using Mail.
Yeah, I do the same thing.
I use Thunderbird and Firefox on all my machines.
Yeah. Well, we always recommend that. We're going to go to another call. We're going to go to Tamara. Tamara, welcome, and where are you?
It's probably Tamara.
Tamara, where are you?
I'm in Santa Cruz.
Okay, Tamara, what's your question?
Just a quick question. I have listened to various times you guys have talked about wireless networks, but I'm feeling comfortable doing that in my home, and I'd like to set up right now I run a DSL peer-to-peer, and I'd like to have a wireless network with one XP machine and one Windows 98.
Okay.
I was just looking for a little bit of guidance as to what I might use, what would be the best equipment.
The best Wi-Fi hub that I know about is what John Tracy has. So, John, what is your Wi-Fi hub?
I don't have it off the top of my head. It's a Netgear.
Okay.
And it uses some, I don't remember what the technology is called. They're touting some new technology that it miraculously increases the range to 500 feet. And it does. It's weird.
Yeah, it covers your whole house and then some, and I'm pretty impressed that I've got another version of some, and it doesn't. But any new Wi-Fi device you pick up at this point is going to be okay on XP and on Windows. And on Macintosh, it's no problem as long as you're running OS 10. I'm assuming.
No, this is XP Home and Windows 98 to PC environment.
Okay, I don't think that's going to be a problem. The big thing you're going to want to do, and most likely, is that you're going to want to hardwire one of those, the desktop machine. You probably want to hardwire.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you want to get a router wireless hub all in one kind of package. It normally has like one in port for coming out of the DSL box and then like four ports for physical THP connection.
Sure.
And then it also has a couple antennas. John, does yours do that? Does it have a hub in it as well?
Yes.
A router? Okay. So that's the package you want to get. It doesn't really matter at this point what you get. It will work with those with Windows machines, I think. Any other input on that? Dee Dee, what are you using for home Wi-Fi?
I have a D-Link router at home now.
Does it work well?
It works really well.
All right.
I'm sorry, I wasn't able to hear that.
A D-Link.
Oh, a D-Link.
Yeah,
I have a D-Link D-Link router now that I use.
Okay, well, you don't have to get rid of that router. You can get a light D-Link hub if you want.
Gateway
device. Yeah. And then keep your current router and just plug them both in. And that way you're spending.
You know what's nice about getting a gateway? If you already have a hub, usually a hub sits in the corner where your internet connection is.
Sure.
Not a great place for your wireless because it's broadcasting across the whole house then. If you get a gateway that just provides wireless access and works in conjunction with your router, probably best to get the same brand when you do this. You can place it in the middle of your house. You just need to run a line to it.
Okay.
And you can increase your coverage that way.
And you run the line from the router to the gateway, and then the machines themselves have the wireless.
Correct. Yeah, and the gateway sitting in the middle of your house. So you've increased the coverage in your house while decreasing coverage outside of your house.
Right. Oh, we like that.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you very much for the call.
Okay.
Goodbye. We're going to say goodbye to Dee Dee now as well. Dee Dee, thank you very much for being on GeekSpeak. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Selkill Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Grey Wolf Computer Systems has provided a grant in support of this program as well. Grey Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz.
Next time on This American Life, stories about the intersection of Christmas and retail, including David Sedaris' story, Santaland Diaries, about David's two Christmas seasons working as an elf in Macy's department store on New York's Herald Square. Also, David Rakoff plays Freud in the windows of Barney's department store. That and other stories on This American Life, Sunday at 10 a.m., right after Car Talk, on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
The geeks this morning were Miles Elam, John Tracy, and Sean Cleveland. Special thanks to our producer, Maggie. Coming up next is Open Road, and at 1 p.m., Two Steps of the Blues with Charlie Lang. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. Santa Cruz, KBH San Auto, or on the web at KUSP.org. I'm Lyle Troxell.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld made an unannounced visit to American troops in Iraq today. Rumsfeld flew by helicopter to a base in Mosul, where this week's bombing at a dining hall killed 22 people, mostly U.S. soldiers. Rumsfeld told the troops he realizes their mission is dangerous and difficult. The defense secretary visited other Iraqi cities as well, including Baghdad.
Once again, we've seen the truth that terrorists can attack at any time, at any place, using any technique, and it is physically impossible to defend in every place against every conceivable technique at any time of the day or night. That fact is a truth, and that truth drives us to the mission that you're on.
Rumsfeld also flew to the cities of Tikrit and Fallujah. The president today made Christmas Eve phone calls to U.S. troops stationed here and abroad. NPR's Debbie Elliott has more.
From Camp David, President Bush called 10 members of the U.S. military, including six stationed in Iraq. The White House says as members of the armed forces sacrificed to protect freedom and liberty, the president wanted to express his gratitude for their service and sacrifice and to wish them all a Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays. In addition to the Iraq cause, the president also spoke with a soldier in South Korea, a Marine corporal stationed in the Atlantic, and Coast Guard officers in Alaska and California. While Mr. Bush used the phone to wish the troops well,